Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. My name's Daniel, and today I'm joined by the lovely Margarita.
Great to be back, and to be joined by Dan again.
Today, we've got On Humans and Animals, on what's next for animal rights, with Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, Peter Singer, and the late, great, pioneering philosopher of ethics and animal rights, Mary Midgley. We're digging into the archive today to bring you an iconic head-to-head between these two fascinating figures of animal rights activism.
If you like this debate, make sure to check out our lineup for this year's How the Light Gets In Festival at Hay. We're going to be joined by Peter Singer again this year, so that's going to be fun.
I heard he'll be debating Slavoj Žižek on the relationship between a universal morality and humanity.
Indeed, that's going to be a fun talk, I think. I don't think they've ever debated in person, so that's going to be really interesting. In today's debate, however, Singer and Midgley explore their life's work, the current state of animal rights activism, and what would constitute further progress in our attitudes towards nature and animals.
Before we hand over to Roger Bolton, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
This is Peter Singer and Mary Midgley on Humans and Animals. Almost 40 years after these two philosophers helped create the idea of animal rights, we're going to try and find out what do they believe would constitute further progress in our attitudes to other forms of life. Live from Melbourne is the philosopher, Princeton professor, and author of Animal Liberation, Peter Singer, and is joining someone here with us who has been called the UK's foremost scourge of scientific pretension. That was The Guardian, of course. Mary Midgley, we're going to consider the past, present, and future of the moral status of animals. So, Professor Singer, let's begin with you. Over to you.
Thank you. First, let me say that it's a pleasure to be here. And Mary, it's a pleasure to be talking to you again after many years, even if at some distance. Because certainly we were both into this issue very early, and it was good to have, although we don't share the same position, as I'm sure will be clear by the end of the hour, I think we do have a lot in common, and I do feel that we're allies in the same cause here. So my interest in this issue goes back to my days as a graduate student in Oxford in the early 1970s, when as a result really of conversations with other graduate students at Oxford who are already interested in the question of animals and how we ought to treat animals, I came to the view that the way in which we think of animals is another example of that familiar phenomenon that we have in which an in-group attributes all of the worth or all of the value, in a word, all of the moral status to itself and develops an ideology built on that which justifies it making use of the out-group in ways that clearly suit its own interests and without giving due concern to that group. And we're familiar with that, of course, in the history of racism, of which the most egregious example and also the one that I think is really most closely parallel to the way we treat animals is slavery based on racial differences, based in particular white slavery of Africans. But we've seen something similar, of course, in the attitudes of males to females in many times and places. And I think that in our attitudes to animals, we have something broadly similar. Now, I obviously don't want to push the parallel too far. There are important differences as well. But we have the idea that only humans really matter, in some way. We have ideologies that support that. For example, we have religious teachings that say that only humans are made in the image of God, or God gave humans dominion over the other animals, that only humans have immortal souls. They resemble religious justifications that also have existed for male supremacy over females and for supremacy of some races over others. And armed with that kind of ideology, and also, of course, with the fact that it has been in our interest to make use of animals, in fact, no doubt for part of our evolutionary history, it may have been essential to us to make use of animals for additional protein. But we turn that into an ideology that justifies us in thinking of animals either as not counting at all morally, and that has been quite a strong current in Western thought, an influential one, I think, in some areas of Western thought, in the Roman Catholic Church, for example, right up until the 19th century. If not that, then the view that their interests are far less than ours, that they can be heavily discounted, perhaps that we ought not to be wantonly cruel to them, that we ought not to, for example, use animals cruelly for our entertainment in dogfighting or bear baiting, or today in bullfighting, but that if we have some interest as we perceive them in using animals, such as the interest in eating them, and from that follows the interest in raising them for our consumption as cheaply as we possibly can, then that interest is always going to trump their interests, or whatever interest they might have, which would be adversely affected by us, for example, trying to raise them for food as cheaply as we can. So the interests of animals get heavily discounted. And the fact that in order to raise them cheaply, we develop technologies that restrict even their minimally basic movements, such as freedom to walk a few steps, to turn around, to bed down in straw rather than on bare concrete, those things get forgotten or neglected because we feel it's in our interest to make use of them. So it was essentially that I was objecting to. And the philosophical foundation for that objection for me was utilitarianism. I was at the time already, and I remain a utilitarian. That means that I think we ought to act so as to produce the best consequences of our actions. And by consequences, I've been concerned with things like the satisfaction of preferences, avoiding the frustration of preferences. I'm also concerned, obviously, with pleasure and pain, as the classical utilitarians have been. So the view that falls out of this, the ethical view regarding animals, or in fact regarding any sentient beings at all, is that they are to be included within the sphere of morality, that they are not to be discounted as such merely because they are not members of the species Homo sapiens. From the moral point of view I'm talking about, membership of the species Homo sapiens is not in itself morally relevant. What is important is that these beings have interests. For example, the interest to avoid pain or to experience pleasure, or not to be bored, or not to be afraid or lonely. I think animals clearly have a range of interests that go beyond pleasure and pain, although we sometimes appeal to that just as a very basic and obvious one. So the interests of non-human animals in avoiding these negative experiences like pain and fear and frustration and boredom and so on should count equally with similar interests of members of our own species. They're not to be discounted because they're not humans. The question, of course, will be raised, what do I mean by similar interests? And that will depend on the cognitive capacities of different beings. So, for instance, if we talk about boredom, no doubt there are different ways in which beings like you and me, capable of listening to this talk to discuss abstract ideas, can be bored, and perhaps pigs can't be bored in that particular way. But that's not to say that they can't be bored at all, and that they don't have an interest in not being bored. So it's a question of trying to assess the interest of animals, trying to say when are they roughly comparable with some interest of humans, and when we do think that they're roughly comparable, to give them equal weight. So that's the principle of equal consideration of interests, which I thought think ought to govern our relation with animals. I don't want to go on too long. We were just asked to do a brief opening statement and get to discussion fairly soon. But I will just say one more thing because it's bound to come up. It doesn't follow from what I've said that the killing of a non-human animal is as serious as the killing of a typical mature human being, again, as the killing of one of us. So it certainly doesn't follow from my views that when I read, for instance, as we all did recently, of the killing of 100 or 150, whatever it was, civilians in Syria, I don't dismiss that and say, well, yes, but you know, how many chickens were slaughtered today worldwide? Many millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps. I don't equate those necessarily, because the differing capacities of those people and of the people who loved them and cared for them, to feel for them, to miss them, and so on, do obviously make a significant difference. So we can say that the wrongness of killing a normal, mature human being is a more serious matter than the wrongness of killing non-human animals. That's not a difference of species. That's not what I call speciesism. Because I think we do have to say, if we're comparing the killing of humans with similar capacities to non-human animals, that at least other things being equal, putting aside the attitudes of relatives and others who love them and care for them, there is a similar loss there. So it would be speciesism to say just because they're members of our species, killing is much more seriously wrong.
I think I have to start my comment by welcoming and celebrating Peter Singer in the strongest terms. He put this thing on the map of thought. There were no classes about it in universities before he published Animal Liberation, and it's made an enormous difference to the general way in which so many of us think. I had not myself noticed factory farming before I read Animal Liberation. There's a very good, simple description of it, not particularly killer motive there, and I was appalled to find that this sort of thing was going on in the modern age, and so were plenty of others. It's caused people to notice it. Now, of course, Peter's right in saying that one reason why they hadn't noticed it before may be attributed to the churches. That is, the exaltation of man, this extraordinary figure, man, had very strong backing from Christianity, and people had come to justify an awful lot of things that they did, including slavery, by saying, we're the children of God and they're not quite, or something of that sort. Now, that's, of course, true, but I want to draw attention to something which Peter hasn't mentioned, that since Christianity became less influential, humanism has come in, and it's just as bad, often. That is, the glorification of man is now given a justification which is often mixed up with evolution. The idea is that it's a survival of the fittest. We've done best, so we obviously deserve to do best. And that sort of justification, I suspect, has been quite as influential, if not more so, in recent times, as the religious one. And it hasn't even got the advantage that there was some sort of moral point with the other one. And it involves a view of ourselves, indeed, as he says, as being supreme, because we're so intelligent and rational, and others are not. And this is a glorification of the cognitive part of ourselves, which is frightfully misleading, which is kind of reading on now to transhumanism, which is going to, oh, we're going to be even better when we're sort of turned into half computers, you know, in various ways, which is the myth of the present age, and I think needs much more attention, you see, than really than the Book of Genesis, at least in this country, maybe not in America. This sort of conceit is what has led us to trash the environment and are still leading us to disastrous policies about it. So the animals are, the problems of the animals are part of that. On the sort of eco scale, they are part of the of that, because the forests are despised in a way that earlier people did not despise them, along with the animals. On the eco scale, I think that's actually something we're probably not going to disagree about much. On the more personal scale, I may have disagreed with him about something, hadn't I? I am much more impressed with the value of the species barrier than he is. It is quite true that we are partial to our own species. It is also true that we are partial to our own children and to those we know and love. This is human nature, and it's there because we are animals. We are animals with a quite definite set of emotional capacities and tendencies. If we try to get rid of those, if we say the affections are making us partial, so let's suppress the emotions, we don't get better, we get worse. But it is essential, of course, to discipline and control that partiality by a rather wider look. And the ground to which I look at that point isn't utilitarianism or any other moral theory, it's the golden rule. You should ask, would you like that done to you? Do you see? Now, I was once in charge of some small children who were being bullied by an older girl. And I said to her, you wouldn't like that if they did it to you. And she grinned and said, they couldn't, could they? Which I think is really the reasoning usually involved. But, I mean, it is... There is also in our nature, and it's in our nature, not just in our societies, a sense of fairness, of looking at the whole and seeing what reason there is why somebody should be treated differently from someone else. Very small children say it isn't fair. They see this before anybody says to them, you've got to look out for fairness. So that I'm not going away from our nature to some sort of cognitive or rational principle in order to say that. Of course, when you've started to think about fairness, your rationality is the way in which we shall express it. Well, this is a difference which makes me not so hostile to the actual eating of animals, as I think he is. I think for the Inuit, who haven't got anything to eat except seals, should eat seals. And that plenty of peoples who are in a rather mixed and confused situation, but who need some animal food in that what else they've got is not quite enough for them, are entitled to kill animals. What they should not do is give them a hopeless life, a life that is no life until they die. And this is a crime committed chiefly by the civilized, not by the primitive. So, I mean, as our situation is now, I think I'd be asked to say, what's the most important bit? The most important bit to me is not the redefining of any particular word like person, but concentrating on factory farming, on the situations in which we give these creatures no life at all. Experimentation probably also does that sometimes, but not on quite the same scale. So that, I think, is where I'll pause.
We're going to try and break this down to three areas. I'd like to take a little bit later the question of the species barrier, and finally I'd like to end up with, as it were, practical concerns that we have at the moment. But first, Professor, I'd like to just ask you briefly whether you share Mary Midge's concern that associated with evolutionists, or often associated with evolutionists, is an increasing arrogance about their ability or right, in a way, to deal with animals as they think fit. Do you detect that yourself?
You were asking me to comment on what Mary Midgley said about humanists.
Yes, only on this point. Only at this stage, on this point, that she says that whereas in the past you could, as it were, point the finger at religion for an arrogance about our superiority to animals, now you're seeing through humanism and particularly through the some views of some evolutionists a similar arrogance about assuming we are a superior form and can treat animals broadly as we decide.
Well, I certainly wouldn't blame humanists for a particular arrogance that is greater than anyone else in the society at this time. I must say, I haven't found that. I found, for example, I've had discussions on this with Richard Dawkins. You can find them on YouTube. I don't find his position entirely satisfactory, but basically he admits that he really ought morally to be a vegetarian. He just says he finds it difficult to avoid eating meat. So I don't find that arrogant. I find that actually a sound intellectual position. Unfortunately, not sufficient moral conviction, if you like, to push it to its proper conclusion. But I've encountered that in the humanist and atheist circles that I move. I've encountered a lot more support for the idea that we ought to be treating animals differently, that we should not separate ourselves from them, that essentially we are animals, as of course Mary and I agree, and that really we should not be trying to lord it over them, that they are entitled to a very different kind of consideration from what we have now.
Can we start then on the ethics of how we treat animals? I wonder if you'd clear something up for me, Professor Singh, which is this. You say somewhere that all animals are equal, and you're keen to break down the barrier between animals and humans. And you also say that our, if you like, the rights of animals, if I understand it correctly, result from the fact that they can feel pain. Does that make you differentiate then between animals, between different sorts of animals? That our approach to animals should be based not on, as it were, some basic rights that they have, but as far as we know they feel pain, we should adjust our view towards them.
Yes, that's correct. And perhaps I should admit that the idea of all animals are equal, which is the title of the first chapter of Animal Liberation, is a shorthand. I mean, it is simplistic. Obviously, the view, as I explained it already in my opening remarks, is more complex than that. But certainly it is essential, even to get to have moral significance, that there be some capacity to feel pain, or at least to have conscious experiences which can be positive or negative. So in that sense, I'm not advocating that all animals are included in the moral sphere, because it's quite possible that things that are, in biological terms, animals, perhaps, say, an oyster, are not capable of feeling pain. And if that's so, if that's a reasoned conclusion, given what we know about oysters and their nervous systems, then it doesn't matter what we do to oysters as far as the oyster is concerned. It may have environmental consequences, of course, dredging the sea for them, but they don't count in the way that animals who are able to feel pain or other emotions.
Some animals we can see feel pain, but we have to experiment to find out whether other animals feel pain. In doing so, we almost invariably inflict pain in order to find out whether it is experienced by animals. So there is not a massive amount of evidence, is there, that about how much animals and which animals feel pain.
It's the wrong place to start. I mean, if you somebody says, but I don't think your dog feels pain, you don't say no experiments have been done on this dog. You say, don't be so silly. I mean, we have enough in common.
Yeah, the dogs wouldn't argue about dogs. Let's try fish.
No, you have to start with the animals that we do know, because the depth of the point becomes clear at this. When you do that, humans have always lived among animals, and they have enough in common with them, the nervous systems of the animals that they meet, to No, quite directly, as indeed they do with other humans. We do not have to do experiments to find out which other...
Well, let me give you an example. When the big debate went on about 15 years ago, about 12 years ago, about whether there should be hunting of deer, and one looked at what was the argument put forward by one side was that deer could anticipate pain, understood that they were being chased and so on. And then one looked for any studies, there were virtually nil. So is it your view that there either is enough statistical, as it were, information available, or that we don't need it for more advanced forms of animals?
It is that we don't need it, and it is just humbug to pretend that we do.
So where's the cut-off point? As you go down the scale?
If you start by understanding this, you'll see that you have to extend it as far as you can, unless you see reason to stop.
And how far would you extend it?
Look, you're misrepresenting the deer situation. Some experimentation was done, which proved that they did mind.
Some, yes. But okay, acknowledging that, how far down do you go in the animal world before you begin to feel confident that either they don't feel pain or they feel a minimal amount of pain? I don't know. Could you tell
me? You don't give them pain unless you have very serious reason to, in any case, and the sort of reason that you have is to assume, for a start, that they probably do feel things that you feel, unless there is reason not to. Now, this is one of the many situations where philosophers start from the wrong end. You put the burden of proof on somebody to prove that it is so. You have already decided that that is what you want to do, and you're going to do it unless somebody stops you. This is the wrong approach. Now, of course, it's true that we can't, on account of mere practical considerations, consider locusts individually, and we sometimes can't consider fish. But fish have, people do, investigate the systems of fish, which are enough to tell them, if they had these genuine doubts in the first place, that it was absurd to pretend that fish did not have pain. Yes?
Can I ask Professor Singer whether he thinks it is necessary to, as it were, establish a flaw with animals in which animals experience pain, or whether we should work on the assumption that until proven otherwise, all animals feel pain?
Well, it depends what you mean by proven otherwise. I mean, I don't think that, for example, I gave the example of an oyster. The animals that we think of as feeling pain, it's clearly evolved to provide them with a danger signal, a warning. You're in a situation that is threatening. You better get out of there. And pain does that effectively.
Yeah.
With an oyster, since it can't move, it might be reasonable to say, well, why would it evolve a capacity for pain? Yeah. What would it have done? Yeah. If we also see that the nervous system is very simple, that it's not centrally organized with a brain or anything like that as ours is, then I would say, yeah, there's a prima facie case for saying that oysters don't feel pain, and I wouldn't say that you have to somehow, some burden to prove that.
It's clear that their nervous systems are quite like ours, and I can't see that anyone could honestly begin to doubt it.
So does that mean that the more pain animals feel, are capable of feeling, the more rights they have, or are they just given an absolute standard of rights? Professor Singer.
Well, you've introduced the word rights.
Yes, let's get rid of it.
A few times.
Right, you dispose of it then, please.
Yes. I don't really consider myself an animal rights advocate in a philosophical sense. Happy to use that label, as I'm happy, I guess, to say all animals are equal, as a kind of a shorthand that the public understands quite well. I mean that I think we ought to radically change the way we treat animals, that we're doing things to them that are clearly wrong. But it's not that I think that they have some basic set of rights that we do. I don't start from a rights foundation. So I would answer your question in this way. I would say, the more we understand about the needs and interests of animals, then the more consideration we owe them for those needs and interests, and perhaps the more they require, so that some animals may require a lot more space, for instance, because they're the kind of species that has an innate desire to travel, to move around. And others, obviously, social mammals need to socialize with others of their type, whereas some creatures are more solitary and don't have an interest in spending time with others of their species. So how we ought to treat them is going to depend on how sophisticated their needs and interests are.
Mary Midgley, could you say why you think there needs to be a species barrier?
Well, there needs to be a species barrier for any species because it can't go about its business if it goes on treating outsiders the same as conspecifics. I mean, penguin that insists on mating with a walrus isn't going to go very well, get on very well, is it? You know, I mean, primarily for reproductive purposes, but also in social animals because they share a social repertoire with those like them. We've been seeing the meerkats lately, you know, and seeing how strong this is, and very strong in elephants and a lot of social creatures. You can't develop the skills and capacities that go with a society unless you have a community of those around you who share roughly the same approach. Now, the interesting thing about people is that they can go beyond this to some extent, which is why they have domesticated animals. Most other creatures won't start up a friendship unless they're isolated on their one of them's isolated on their own. Won't start up a friendship with other creatures around. But people do, and obviously the whole business of domesticating from picking up wolves and turning them into dogs has gone on in that sort of way. This is part of our nature, and I think it's rather a grand and celebratable thing.
So I could ask you then how you respond to what is, I'm told, is a review by Professor Singer of Midas Decker's Dearest Pet on Bestiality, when Professor Singer is said to have argued that whereas sexual activities between humans and animals that result in harm to the animal should remain illegal, but that, and it says it's a quote, sex with animals does not always involve cruelty, and that, quote again, mutually satisfying activities of a sexual nature may sometimes occur between humans and animals. Is that... How do you respond to that?
I don't know enough about how it all goes on to comment, and I think it's a bloody trivial point, which only the media would have made so much of.
Well, it's not big. Well, it may well be a trivial point, but it's
in the context of animal ill treatment.
No, it's about barriers. What we're talking about, animal mistreatment, we are indeed talking about. But we're also talking about the speciesism here and the question of the barriers that exist or should exist between species. And if I understand,
I'm not saying that this is normal behavior or that it's widespread behavior. So it doesn't show that I think that there are no barriers. I'm just reporting what you read is, it was a book review and it was reported in the book. There were many illustrations that this can happen. And it seems to be the case that some humans do get sexual satisfaction from contact with animals, and they can do it in ways that's some of them that do not actually harm the animals. So that's just a description of, if you like, the wide boundaries of human sexual tastes, which we know about already, I think. Yeah. And Mary Midgley is absolutely right that it has nothing to do with, neither with the species barrier issue you're raising, nor, of course, with the huge amount of suffering that humans inflict on animals.
Yeah.
When you're looking at human beings who are in a state, maybe through Alzheimer's disease and so on, so that their levels of, how can one put this, intelligent awareness of the world are perhaps less than animals, and that one's attitude to human beings in those circumstances should not be qualitatively different from the attitude to animals in those circumstances. Is that a fair summary of your view?
No, it's not at all a fair summary of my views. Since you mentioned people with Alzheimer's, who, of course, have been people who we have known. I mean, my mother sadly had Alzheimer's in her last years. And so, of course, we respect them and interact with them in a way that reflects the fact that we have known and loved them for many years, and we want to treat them with respect and to some extent in the way they would have wanted to be treated, which of course may be that what they would have wanted was for someone to give them a lethal injection. That's possible in some cases and not the case in others. I think if you'd made your point with regard to infants born with very severe disabilities who therefore will never be able to be in a situation where they have any cognitive capacities beyond those that roughly similar to those of some species of non-human animals, then perhaps I would have been closer to saying that, yes, you know, obviously there are still differences. They will still have human parents as parents who have attitudes towards them that are relevant. But I think that that's a closer comparison. And part of my point here is that I think when people say that despite the fact that these humans are born with disabilities that mean they will never exceed the cognitive capacities of, let's say, a dog or a pig, that nevertheless their lives are sacred and nevertheless we must treat them in ways that are far better than we do treat non-human animals. That seems to me to show a bias in favour of members of our species, which I don't think is defensible.
Casimir Midgley, do you share that bias then? The description of a child born with such limitations that they do not, in a sense, deserve to be considered de facto superior to animals?
I don't think that's the way to look at the question at all.
Well, would you mind addressing that point, though? I'm respected, but that is what some people will interpret the professor as saying, and I wanted your response to that.
My response is people who have to deal with the fate of such children have a very difficult problem of balancing such value as there is in this life against the drawbacks of it. And I think it's very startling, really, how the principle referred to, which you have referred to, is that human life is sacred. Now, the word sacred is hardly used of anything else at present.
No, I haven't said sacred, but perhaps
I'm
because
drunk to
it's
say
human.
What I'm saying.
Sorry, beg pardon.
It really is very odd, and the other context in which it's particularly odd is when people who are extremely ill and dying and wish to die are not allowed to die. The reason why they are not allowed to die is to me totally obscure, seeing that we make so much fuss about freedom in all the rest of our morality. I think it's very odd. The only reason why I think that goes on is that some people are afraid of somebody being sued if they let them die.
But with Professor, I did not mention sacred and I didn't mention those things. The point I'm trying to get at is whether, by virtue of being human in those circumstances, regardless of intelligence, attributes, or whatever, you would believe there is a distinction between treating the baby described by the professor in that way differently from an animal.
I think that a baby whose life is not going to be worth living is, as I started by saying, presents a problem to those caring for it, which might quite reasonably be solved by letting it go. And I think the same about a puppy. I said it's the life that the being can have that one has to consider.
Thanks for listening to Philosophy for Our Times. We now have an email, so get in contact at podcast@ii.tv with any questions for the editorial team or the speakers that you heard in today's episode. We'll do our best to get answers for you in next week's podcast. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.